This is Audible.
Oshet Audio presents Bossy Pants, written and read by Tina Fey, including bonus material, which is a Mac and PC compatible PDF.
For Jean Fey, happy Mother's Day. I made this out of macaroni for you. Welcome, friend. Congratulations on your purchase of this American-made genuine audiobook. Each component of this audiobook was selected to provide you with maximum audio performance, whatever your listening needs may be. If you're a woman and you bought this audiobook for practical tips on how to make it in a male-dominated workplace, here they are. No pigtails, no tube tops, cry sparingly. Some people say, never let them see you cry. I say, if you're so mad you could just cry, then cry. It terrifies everyone. When choosing sexual partners, remember, talent is not sexually transmittable. Also, don't eat diet foods in meetings. Perhaps you're a parent and you bought this audiobook to learn how to raise an achievement-oriented, drug-free adult virgin. You'll find that too. The essential ingredients, I can tell you up front, are a strong father figure, bad skin, and a child-sized colonial lady outfit. Maybe you bought this book because you love Sarah Palin and you want to find reasons to hate me. We've got that! I use all kinds of elitist words like impervious and gerund, and I think gay people are just as good at watching their kids play hockey as straight people. Maybe it's 70 years in the future and you found this audiobook in a stack of junk being used to block the entrance of an abandoned Starbucks that is now a feeding station for the alien militia. If that's the case, I have some questions for you, such as, did we really ruin the environment as much as we thought, and is Glee still a thing? If you're looking for a spiritual allegory in the style of C.S. Lewis, I guess you could piece something together with Lorne Michaels as a symbol for God and my struggles with hair removal as a metaphor for virtue. Or perhaps you just bought this audiobook to laugh and be entertained. For you, I have included this joke. Two peanuts were walking down the street, and one was assaulted. Peanut. You see, I just want you to get your money's worth. Anyone who knows me will tell you that I am all about money. I mean, just look how well my line of Zodiac-inspired toe rings and homeopathic children's medications are selling on Home Shopping Network. Because I am nothing if not an amazing businesswoman, I researched what kind of content makes for best-selling books. It turns out the answer is one-night stands, drug addictions, and recipes. Here, we are out of luck. But I can offer you lurid tales of anxiety and cowardice. Why is this audiobook called Bossy Pants? One, because the name Two and a Half Men was already taken. And two, because ever since I became an executive producer of 30 Rock, people have asked me, is it hard for you being the boss, and is it uncomfortable for you to be the person in charge? You know, in that same way they say, gosh, Mr. Trump, is it awkward for you to be the boss of all these people? I can't answer for Mr. Trump, but in my case, it is not. I've learned a lot in the past 10 years about what it means to be the boss of people. In most cases, being a good boss means hiring talented people and then getting out of their way. In other cases, to get the best work out of people, you may have to pretend you are not their boss and let them treat someone else like the boss, and then that person whispers to you behind a fake wall and you tell them what to tell the first person. Contrary to what I believed as a little girl, being the boss almost never involves marching around waving your arms and chanting, I am the boss! I am the boss! For me, this audiobook has been an almost pleasurable task of retracing my steps to figure out what factors contributed to this little soccer nerd developing into this fancy glamour lady who secretly prefers to be this weirdo on roller skates in a wig. For clarification, you can check the PDF. I hope you enjoy this audiobook. I hope you enjoy it so much that you also buy a copy for your sister-in-law. Sincerely, Tina Fey, New York City, 2011. It's so hard to believe it's 2011 already. I'm still writing Tina Fey, grade 4, room 207 on all my checks. Origin story. My brother is 8 years older than I am. I was a big surprise, a wonderful surprise, my mom would be quick to tell you. Although having a baby at 40 is a commonplace fool's errand these days, back in 1970, it was pretty unheard of. Women around my mom's office referred to her pregnancy as Mrs. Fey and her change-of-life baby. When I was born, I was fussed over and doted on, and my brother has always looked out for me like a third parent. The day before I started kindergarten, my parents took me to the school to meet the teacher. My mom had taken my favorite blanket and stitched my initials into it for nap time, just like she'd done for my brother 8 years earlier. At the teacher conference, my dad tried to give my nap time blanket to the teacher, and she just smiled and said, "Oh, we don't do that anymore." That's when I realized I had old parents, and I've been worried about them ever since. While my parents talked to the teacher, I was sent to a table to do coloring. I was introduced to a Greek boy named Alex, whose mom was next in line to meet with the teacher. We colored together in silence. I was so used to being praised and encouraged that when I finished my drawing, I held it up to show Alex, who immediately ripped it in half. I didn't have the language to express my feelings then, but my thoughts were something like, "Oh, it's like that, motherfucker? Got it." Mrs. Fay's change-of-life baby had entered the real world. During the spring semester of kindergarten, I was slashed in the face by a stranger in the alley behind my house. Don't worry, I'm not going to lay out the grisly details for you like a Sweeps episode of Dateline. I only bring it up to explain why I'm not going to talk about it. I've always been able to tell a lot about people by whether they ask me about my scar. Most people never ask, but if it comes up naturally somehow and I offer up the story, they are quite interested. Some people are just dumb. Did a cat scratch you? God bless. Those sweet dum-dums, I never mind. Sometimes it is a fun sociology litmus test, like when my friend Ricky asked me, "Did they ever catch the black guy that did that to you?" It's not a black guy, Ricky. And I never said it was. Then there's another sort of person who thinks it makes them seem brave or sensitive or wonderfully direct to ask me about it right away. They ask with quiet, feigned empathy, "How did you get your scar?" The grossest move is when they say they're only curious because it's so beautiful. Ugh, disgusting. They might as well walk up to you and say, "May I be amazing at you?" To these folks, let me be clear. I am not interested in acting out a TV movie with you where you befriend a girl with a scar. An Oscar-y Spielberg movie where I play a mean German with a scar? Yes. My whole life, people who ask about my scar within 1 week of knowing me have invariably turned out to be egomaniacs of average intelligence or less. And egomaniacs of average intelligence or less often end up in the field of TV journalism. So, you see, if I tell the whole story here, then I will be asked about it over and over by the hosts of Access Movie Town and Entertainment Forever for the rest of my short-lived career. But I will tell you this. My scar was a miniature form of celebrity. Kids knew who I was because of it. Lots of people like to claim they were there when it happened. I was there. I saw it. Crazy Mike did it. Adults were kind to me because of it. Aunts and family friends gave me Easter candy and oversized Hershey kisses long after I was too old for presents. I was made to feel special. What should have shut me down and made me feel less than ended up giving me an inflated sense of self. It wasn't until years later, maybe not until I was writing this audiobook, that I realized people weren't making a fuss over me because I was some incredible beauty or genius. They were making a fuss over me to compensate for my being slashed. I accepted all that attention at face value and proceeded through life as if I really was extraordinary. I guess what I'm saying is, this has all been a wonderful misunderstanding. And I shall keep these Golden Globes. Every last one. Growing up and liking it. At 10, I asked my mother if I could start shaving my legs. My dark shin fur was hard to ignore in shorts weather, especially since my best friend Maureen was a pale Irish lass who probably doesn't have any leg hair to this day. My mom said it was too soon and that I would regret it, but she must have looked at my increasingly hairy and sweaty frame and known that something was brewing. A few months later, she gave me a box from the Modest Company. It was a My First Period kit, and inside were samples of pads and panty liners and two pamphlets. One with the vaguely threatening title, Growing Up and Liking It, and one called, How Shall I Tell My Daughter? I'm pretty sure my mom was supposed to read that one and then talk to me about it, but she just gave me the whole box and slipped out of the room. Growing Up and Liking It was a fake correspondence between three young friends. Through their spunky interchange, all my questions and fears about menstruation would be answered. Dear Ginny, I finally got my friend today. Yay, it's about time. If I roller skate while I'm menstruating, will I die? Dear Pam, of course you can roller skate. Don't be silly, but be careful of odor or neighborhood dogs may try to bite your vagina. Friends forever, Ginny. Dear Tabitha, sometimes I get stomach cramps on the first day of my period. My mom showed me some stretches I can do, but I also heard that drinking peach schnapps will work. Dear Ginny, peach schnapps will work. Act like you're putting orange juice in it, but then don't. Dear Pam, I'm supposed to go to a pool party this week, but my Aunt Blood is still in town. Can I go? Dear Tabitha, of course you can still go. Modest makes great feminine protection products that are so thick and puffy, you'll be super comfortable sitting on that bench near the pool telling everyone you're sick. How shall I tell my daughter? As I nauseously perused How Shall I Tell My Daughter, I started to suspect that my mom had not actually read the pamphlet before handing it off to me. Here is a real quote from the actual 1981 edition. A book, a teacher, or a friend may provide her with some of the facts of the menstrual cycle, but only you, the person who has been teaching her about life and growing up since she was an infant, can provide the warm guidance and understanding that is vital. Well played, Jean Fay. Well played. The explanatory text was followed by a lot of drawings of the human reproductive system that my brain refused to memorize. To this day, all I know is that there are between 2 and 4 openings down there, and that the setup inside looks vaguely like the Texas Longhorns logo. I shoved the box in my closet where it haunted me daily. There might as well have been a guy dressed like Freddy Krueger in there for the amount of anxiety it gave me. Every time I reached in the closet to grab a Sunday school dress or my colonial lady Halloween costume that I sometimes relaxed in after school, Modess, it hissed at me. Modess is coming for you. Then it happened. In the spring of 1981, I achieved menarche while singing Neil Diamond's Song Sung Blue at a district-wide chorus concert. I was 10 years old. I had noticed something was weird earlier in the day, but I knew from commercials that one's menstrual period was a blue liquid that you poured like laundry detergent onto maxi pads to test their absorbency. This wasn't blue, so I ignored it for a few hours. When we got home, I pulled my mom aside to ask her if it was weird that I was bleeding in my underpants. She was very sympathetic, but also a little baffled. Her eyes said, "Dummy, didn't you read How Shall I Tell My Daughter?" I had read it. But nowhere in the pamphlet did anyone say that your period was not a blue liquid. At that moment, 2 things became clear to me. I was now technically a woman, and I would never be a doctor. When did you first know you were a woman? When I was writing the movie Mean Girls, which hopefully is playing on TBS right now, I went to a workshop taught by Rosalind Wiseman as part of my research. Rosalind wrote the nonfiction book Queen Bees and Wannabes that Mean Girls was based on, and she conducted a lot of self-esteem and bullying workshops with women and girls around the country. She did this particular exercise in a hotel ballroom in Washington, D.C. with about 200 grown women, asking them to write down the moment they first knew they were a woman, meaning, when did you first feel like a grown woman and not a girl? We wrote down our answers and shared them, first in pairs, then in larger groups. The group of women was racially and economically diverse, but the answers had a very similar theme. Almost everyone first realized they were becoming a grown woman when some dude did something nasty to them. I was walking home from ballet and a guy in a car yelled, "Lick me." I was babysitting my younger cousins when a guy drove by and yelled, "Nice ass." There were pretty much 0 examples like, "I first knew I was a woman when my mother and father took me out to dinner to celebrate my success on the debate team." It was mostly men yelling shit from cars. Are they a patrol sent out to let girls know they've crossed into puberty? If so, it's working. I experienced car creepery at 13. I was walking home from middle school past a place called the World's Largest Aquarium, which legally, I don't know how they could call it that, because it was obviously an average-sized aquarium. Maybe I should start referring to myself as the world's tallest man, see how that goes. Anyway, I was walking home alone from school and I was wearing a dress. A dude drove by and yelled, "Nice tits!" Embarrassed and enraged, I screamed after him, "Suck my dick!" Sure, it didn't make any sense, but at least I didn't hold in my anger. Thankfully, blessedly, yelling, "Suck my dick," is not the moment I really associate with entering womanhood. For me, it was when I bought a kick-ass white denim suit at the Springfield Mall. I bought it with my own money under the advisement of my cool friend Sandy. I wore it to Senior Awards Night 1988, where it blew people's minds as I accepted the Sunday School scholarship. a turned-up collar, the jacket that zipped all the way down the front into a nice fitted shape, the white denim that made my untanned skin look like a color. Just once I'd like to find an Oscars or Emmy dress as rad as that suit. Check the PDF. That suit's going to blow your mind. Suburban girl seeks urban healthcare. It may have been a mistake to have my first ever gynecology appointment at a Planned Parenthood on North Side of Chicago. I was 23, and honestly, there was no need. My whole setup was still factory new. But I had never been, and I had some insurance, so, you know, why not be proactive about my health like the educated young feminist I was? I slipped on my pumpkin-colored swing coat with the Sojourner Truth button on it and headed to their grim location in Rogers Park. All the windows were covered, and you had to be buzzed in through two different doors. This place was not kidding around. I sat among the AIDS posters, proudly reading Toni Morrison's Jazz. Maybe later I would treat myself to sweet potato fries at the Heartland Cafe. I was taken to an examining room where a big butch nurse practitioner came in and asked me if I was pregnant. No way! Was I sexually active? Nope. Had I ever been molested? Well, I said, trying to make a joke, Oprah says the only answers to that question are yes and I don't remember. I laughed. We were having fun. The nurse looked at me, concerned slash annoyed. Have you ever been molested? Oh, no. Then she took out a speculum the size of a milkshake machine. Even Michelle Duggar would have flinched at this thing, but I had never seen one before. Well, what's that device for? Before I could finish, the nurse inserted the milkshake machine to the hilt, and I fainted. I was awakened by a sharp smell. An assistant had been called in, I'm sure, for legal reasons, and was waving smelling salts under my nose. As I came to, the nurse said, You have a short vagina. I think I hit you in the cervix. And then I fainted again, even though no one was even touching me. I just went out, like she had hit a reset button. I'm surprised I didn't wake up speaking Spanish like Buzz Lightyear. When I woke up the second time, the nurse was openly irritated with me. Did I have someone who could come and pick me up? Nope. You're going to have to make another appointment. I couldn't finish the pap smear. Why didn't you finish it while I was out? I yelled. Apparently, it's against the law. Then she asked if I could hurry up and get out because she needed to perform an abortion on Wilona from Good Times. All girls must be everything. When I was 13, I spent a weekend at the beach in Wildwood, New Jersey with my teenage cousins Janet and Lori. In the space of 36 hours, they taught me everything I know about womanhood. They knew how to lay out in the sun wearing tanning oil instead of sunscreen. They taught me that you could make a reverse tattoo in your tan if you cut a shape out of a Band-Aid and stuck it to your leg. They taught me you could listen to General Hospital on the radio if you turned the FM dial way down to the bottom. Wildwood is a huge, wide beach. The distance from your towel to the water was often equal to the distance from your motel to your towel. And back in the day, the place was packed exclusively with very, very tan Italian-Americans and very, very burned Irish-Americans. As a little kid, I almost always got separated from my parents and would panic trying to find them among the dozens and dozens of similar umbrellas. One afternoon, a girl walked by in a bikini and my cousin Janet scoffed, "Look at the hips on her." I panicked. What about the hips? Were they too big? Too small? What were my hips? I didn't know hips could be a problem. I thought they were just fat or skinny. This was how I found out that there are an infinite number of things that can be incorrect on a woman's body. At any given moment on planet Earth, a woman is buying a product to correct one of the following deficiencies. Big pores, oily T-zone, cankles, five head, lunch lady arms, nipples too big, nipples too small, breasts too big, breasts too small, one breast bigger than the other, one breast smaller than the other. How are these two things different? I don't know. Nasal labial folds. No arch in my eyebrows. FUPA, a delightfully crude acronym for a protruding lower belly. Muffin top, spider veins, saddlebags, crotch biscuits. That's what I call the wobbly triangles in your inner thighs. Thin lashes, bony knees, low hairline, calves too big. No calves! Green undertones in my skin. And my personal favorite, bad nail beds. In hindsight, I'm pretty sure Janet meant the girl's hips were too wide. This was the late 70s, and the 70s were a small-eyed, thin-lipped, blonde woman's paradise. I remember watching Three's Company as a little brown-haired kid thinking, really? This is what we get? Joyce DeWitt is our brunette representative? She's got that greasy-looking bowl cut and they make her wear suntan pantyhose under her football jersey nightshirt? I may only have been 7 or 8, but I knew that this sucked. The standard of beauty was set. Cheryl Teagues, Farrah Fawcett, Christy Brinkley. Small eyes, toothy smile, boobies, no buttocks, yellow hair. Let's talk about the hair for a minute. Why do I call it yellow hair and not blonde hair? Because I'm pretty sure everybody calls my hair brown. When I read fairy tales now to my daughter, I always change the word blonde to yellow because I don't want her to think that blonde hair is somehow better. My daughter has a reversible doll, Sleeping Beauty on one side and Snow White on the other. I would always set it on her bed with the Snow White side out, and she would toddle up to it and flip the skirt over to Sleeping Beauty. I would flip it back and say, "Snow White is so pretty." She would yell, "No!" and flip it back. I did this experiment so frequently and consistently that I should have applied for government funding. The result was always the same. When I asked her why she didn't like Snow White, she told me, "I don't like her hair." Not even 3 years old, she knew that yellow hair is king. And let's admit it, yellow hair does have magic powers. You could put a blonde wig on a hot water heater and some dude would try to fuck it. Snow White is better looking. I hate to stir up trouble among the princesses, but take away the hair and Sleeping Beauty is actually a little beat. Sure, when I was a kid, there were beautiful brunettes to be found. Linda Ronstadt, Jacqueline Smith, the little Spanish singer on the Lawrence Welk show. But they were regarded as a fun, exotic alternative. Farrah was vanilla and Jacqueline Smith was chocolate. Can you remember a time when pop culture was so white that Jacqueline Smith was the chocolate? By the 80s, we started to see some real chocolate. Holly Berry and Naomi Campbell, Downtown Julie Brown and Tyra Banks. But I think the first real change in women's body image came when J-Lo turned it butt style. That was the first time that having a large-scale situation in the back was part of mainstream American beauty. Girls wanted butts now. Men were free to admit that they had always enjoyed them. And then, what felt like moments later, boom, Beyoncé brought the leg meat. A back porch and thick muscular legs were now widely admired. And from that day forward, women embraced their diversity and realized that all shapes and sizes are beautiful. No, I'm totally messing with you. All Beyoncé and J-Lo have done is add to the laundry list of attributes women must have to qualify as beautiful. Now, every girl is expected to have Caucasian blue eyes, full Spanish lips, a classic button nose, hairless Asian skin with a California tan, a Jamaican dance hall ass, long Swedish legs, small Japanese feet, the abs of a lesbian gym owner, the hips of a 9-year-old boy, the arms of Michelle Obama, and doll tits. The person closest to actually achieving this look is Kim Kardashian, who, as we now know, was made by Russian scientists to sabotage our athletes. Everyone else is struggling. Even the yellow hairs who were once on top can now be found squatting to a Rihanna song in a class called Gary's Glutes Camp in an attempt to reverse engineer a butt. These are dark times. Back in my Wildwood days with Janet, you were either blessed with a beautiful body or not. And if you were not, you could just chill out and learn a trade. Now, if you're not hot, you are expected to work on it until you are. It's like when you renovate a house and you're legally required to leave just one of the original walls standing. If you don't have a good body, you better starve the body you have down to a neutral shape, then bolt on some breast implants, replace your teeth, dye your skin orange, inject your lips, sew on some hair, and call yourself the Playmate of the Year. How do we survive this? How do we teach our daughters and our gay sons that they are good enough the way they are? We have to lead by example. Instead of trying to fit an impossible ideal, I took a personal inventory of all my healthy body parts for which I am grateful. Straight Greek eyebrows. They start at the hairline at my temple and, left unchecked, will grow straight across my face and onto yours. A heart-shaped ass. Unfortunately, it's a right-side-up heart, and the point is at the bottom. Droopy brown eyes designed to confuse predators into thinking I'm just on the verge of sleep and they should come back tomorrow to eat me. Permanently rounded shoulders from years of working at a computer. A rounded belly that is pushed out by my rounded posture no matter how many sit-ups I do, which is mostly none. A small, high waist. A wad of lower back fat that never went away after I lost my baby weight. One day in the next 10 years, this back roll will meet up with my front pouch, forever obscuring my small, high waist, and I will officially be my mother. Wide-set knockers that aren't so big but can be hoisted up once or twice a year for parades. Good, strong legs with big gym teacher calves that I got from walking pigeon-toed my whole life. wide German hips that looked like somebody wrapped Pillsbury dough around a case of soda. My father's feet, flat, bony, pale. I don't even know how he gets around because his feet are in my shoes. I would not trade any of these features for anybody else's. I wouldn't trade the small, thin-lipped mouth that makes me resemble my nephew. I wouldn't even trade the acne scar on my right cheek because that recurring zit spent more time with me in college than any boy ever did. At the end of the day, I'm happy to have my father's feet and my mother's eyes with me at all times. If I ever go back to that beach in Wildwood, I want my daughter to be able to find me in the crowd by spotting my soda case hips. I want her to be able to pick me out of a sea of highlighted blonde women with fake tans because I'm the one with the thick ponytail and the greenish undertones in my skin. And if I ever meet Joyce DeWitt, I will first apologize for having immediately punched her in the face, and then I will thank her. For while she looked like a Liza Minnelli doll that had been damaged in a fire, at least she didn't look like everybody else on TV. Also, full disclosure, I would trade my feet for almost any other set of feet out there. Delaware County Summer Showtime. All names in this story have been changed to protect the fabulous gay whales. In 1976, a young Catholic family man named Larry Wentzler started a youth theater program in my hometown called Summer Showtime. It really is a terrific model for a community program. Young teenagers would put on daily children's theater shows for the community, giving preschoolers access to live theater at a very low cost for parents. The older kids would direct those children's theater shows and perform in Broadway-style musicals by night. In the process, all the kids would learn about music, art, carpentry, discipline, friendship, and teamwork. It's a fantastic program that continues to this day, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Larry didn't set out to create a haven for gay teens, but you know how sometimes squirrels eat out of a bird feeder? Larry had built a beautiful bird feeder, and the next thing you know, it's full of squirrels. I took a job as the night box office manager at Summer Showtime because my 11th grade boyfriend had said we'd have fun there. He promptly broke up with me to date a hot blonde dancer to whom he is now married. God bless us, everyone. I should have known that he and I weren't going to make it when, for my 17th birthday, he gave me a box of microwave popcorn and a used battery tester. You know, to test batteries before I put them in my Walkman. Like you give someone when you're in love. Those first few nights of being freshly, brutally dumped and sitting alone in the box office were not so great. I was heartbroken, and because no one had central air back then, I had to cry myself to sleep on the floor under the air conditioner in my parents' room. But then, like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, my world went from black and white to color. Because, like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, I was embraced by the gays. They loved me and praised me. I was so funny and so mean and so mature for my age. And with my large brown eyes, I really did look like a young, not Judy Garland, Lorna Luft. A young Lorna Luft. Before my evening shift, I would hang out with my new friend Tim, who ran the costume department. Tim had the highest, loudest voice you've ever heard. I could sit there for hours listening to him screech along to "And I Am Telling You I'm Not Going," while hot gluing Joseph's amazing Technicolor dream coat together, because none of us could really sew. Parents of the world, this is where you want your 17-year-old daughter spending her summer, snorting her DQ Blizzard out of her nose from laughing so hard. The only person funnier than Tim was his meaner, louder, higher-pitched brother, Tristan. One family, two impressively gay brothers. That summer, I got to know four families in which half the children were gay. In case you're interested from a sociological point of view, they were always Catholic, and there were always four kids, two of whom were gay. What Wales is to crooners, my hometown may be to homosexuals, meaning there seemed to be a disproportionate number of them, and they are the best in the world. Tristan would egg me on to trash-talk the little blondie who had stolen my boyfriend. Of course, I know now that no one can steal boyfriends against their will, not even Angelina Jolie itself. But I was filled with a poisonous, pointless teenage jealousy, which, when combined with gay cattiness, can be intoxicating. Like mean meth. And guess who played Joseph in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, by the way? Oh, you guessed it. Old battery tester Joe. I got to sit through watching him in the show every night, and then count my stubs in a 4-foot room while he and the blonde left to get pizza. He would have never given her a crappy battery tester. And if he did, she probably would have shoved it up her twat and tried to turn it on. That's the kind of mean stuff that Tristan and I bonded over. Clearly, it's very toxic. The unstated thing that Tim and I had in common was that we had crushes on all the same boys. The only difference was I was allowed to talk endlessly about my feelings, and Tim was in the half closet. Nobody thought he was straight, but he wasn't out either. He certainly never made a move on anyone. His crushes would manifest themselves in other ways. Tim had a real job working at Macy's, and sometimes he would use his disposable income to, you know, buy Rick McManaman a baseball glove. Oh, you were saying the other night after rehearsal how you needed a glove, so anyhow, he'd trail off. The nice thing was the straight boys didn't freak out about this, and they definitely kept all the free stuff. Lots of teenage girls have taken comfort under the wings of half-closeted gay boys, but how many of us can brag that her two best friends in high school were 25-year-old lesbians? I met Karen and Sharon one day in the middle of our giant 1,000-seat auditorium. The kid who ran the lighting booth, a roughneck girl named Rita, who would only answer to Reet, was climbing from ladder to ladder, hanging lights for the Jungle Book, and cursing like a sailor with a corneal paper cut. Karen was the improv teacher, and Sharon was the head scenic painter, and the three of us found ourselves spellbound by the spinning mobile of profanity that was Reet hanging from the ceiling. It was like looking in the monkey cage, but you can understand the monkey, and what the monkey is saying is, oh, fuck all these fucking zoo people. We started laughing, and we were inseparable for the next 6 years. Karen and Sharon had been a couple at some unspecified time in the past, but were now just friends with asymmetrical haircuts. We spent days and weeks doing nothing, calling one another 10 times a day to schedule our nothing doing. An entire evening could consist of renting a movie such as The Stepfather or that one where spiders come out of Martin Sheen's face and making nachos. Do you remember what a cultural phenomenon homemade nachos were? If you're under 30, you probably don't even realize that there was a time when people didn't have nachos. We just stood around eating crackers. You know that game Celebrity that you and your friends invented in college? Well, first of all, you didn't invent it. It was developed by NASA to keep girls virgins well into their 20s. And second of all, we played it better than you because we played it 4 nights a week. We wore it out. Okay, this is Joan Collins' character from Dynasty. Alexis! No, her full name. Alexis Carrington Colby Dexter. Yes! When we finally got tired of playing around midnight, we would switch to a version called Celebrity Boff, in which you could only write down the names of celebrities you would sleep with. Playing Celebrity Boff with two half-closeted gay guys, two lesbians, and one straight girl made for an easy game. Jodie Foster's name was always in there like 4 times. Antonio Banderas appealed to all sectors. Okay, this is that same one we keep getting. Princess Stephanie of Monaco. Yes! It is a testament to my parents that they never reacted negatively to the 4-year-long pride parade that marched through their house. They welcomed these weirdos. They were weirdos in other ways, not because of their sexual preference. With open arms and fed them all until they were sick. Only once did my mother say, "That Karen is a little butch, don't you think?" I feigned ignorance badly. "I not know what you mean." And slipped out for a night of same-sex nachos and name-yelling. I guess I should also state that Karen and Sharon never hit on me in the slightest, and it was never weird between any of us. Gay people don't actually try to convert people. That's Jehovah's Witnesses that you're thinking of. No one was ever turned gay by being at summer showtime, because that's not possible. If you could turn gay from being around gay people, wouldn't Kathy Griffin be Rosie O'Donnell by now? The straight boys quickly learned to be accepting and easygoing, and the straight girls learned over the course of several years to stop falling in love with gay boys. By August, I was coming out of my gloom. I took a free afternoon dance class where we basically just did jazz runs back and forth across the lobby. The teacher called me Frankenstein arms because I would move my right arm in unison with my right leg, like a Frankenstein. Since I had been thrown over for a dancer, this stung, but I persevered. I was the youngest person in our group of friends, and I always had a curfew. I was notorious for freaking out when it was time to go. It didn't matter if we were at local eatery The Critic's Choice enjoying mozzarella sticks after a rehearsal, or at Tim and Tristan's house watching Sleepaway Camp, the one where the demonic little girl turns out to have a penis. When I had to go, I would shut a party down. "Hurry up, I don't want to get in trouble," pleaded 80s bossy pants. When the summer was over, I had made about 25 new friends and was no longer weeping into my mom's radiator cover. But most of the kids in Summer Showtime went to the Catholic schools down the road or were well into their 20s, so I didn't see them as much once school started. After the greatest summer. I had to take 11th grade health in 12th grade. I had postponed it the year before so I could take choir and encore singers. It was kind of a big deal to be in both, whatever. I was alto one, but sometimes they had me sing second soprano. I had a solo in O Holy Night in a performance at the mall in downtown Philadelphia. It's enough. Stop asking about it. Anyway, the health teacher, Mr. Garth, was also our assistant football coach and a chimney sweep. We knew this because he drove to work in his Garth chimney sweep van. He had a thick blonde mustache, the universal sign of intelligence, and a rural Pennsylvania accent that made him say Don instead of down, and human instead of human. One day, in what I hope was a departure from the state curriculum, Mr. Garth devoted an entire period to teaching us how to spot and avoid homosexuals. I could not believe what I was hearing. I don't know what happened to this guy at the Teachers College of Anthraciteville, but he had some opinions. These homosexuals, they'll trick you. They'll find out what kind of music you like, what kind of candy you like, and they'll invite you down to their house. As I listened, incredulous, I couldn't help but picture a young Mr. Garth being lured into a van by Paul Lynde. Hey there, Sonny. My friends and I were just going into the woods to enjoy some Jethro Tull and a Mars bar. Interested? Oh, the shame that must have washed over Mr. Garth as Minstrel in the Gallery came to an end, and he realized that was no Mars bar, but there was no turning back. He had already eaten half of it. My blood started to boil as he continued. If you're talking to someone and you think they might be a homosexual, just run. Just get out of there and tell the nearest adult. I stayed after class to tell him that I thought he had misspoken. I think what you meant to say was child molesters, not homosexuals. He just watched my hands move as I talked, not unlike a dog. It became clear that my school life and my Showtime life were separate. The greatest New Year's Eve party of all time. The line between Showtime friends and school friends was breached on New Year's Eve, 1987. My Summer Showtime friend Brendan had a New Year's Eve party. Brendan was a very dramatic boy who would say things to me like, "Did you ever think that maybe the man that did that to your face did it to mark you so he could find you later in life?" See what I mean about the question being a reflection of the asker? When Brendan occasionally lost himself in a long, dramatic rant, you could always shut him up by saying things like, "Oh, I like that monologue. Is that from Night Mother?" He had a beautiful face, with pouty lips and that swoopy hair that was so popular during the second Reagan administration. He was the scenic artist under Sharon, and he would do things like paint the entire floor of the stage an hour before a performance, ruining the white shorts the kids had been asked to bring in from home to be in the chorus of Free to Be You and Me. Then he'd disappear for 2 days, emerging with a 10-page letter of apology. He was a mess, and his New Year's party was expected to be awesome. I was a teetotaler at the time, and none of my close friends were big drinkers. I went with Karen and Sharon, and the place was already packed when we got there. The kitchen and dining room were full of Brendan's athletic Catholic school friends, and the living room was packed with theater nerds. Brendan's mom had locked herself in her room upstairs. There was an unclaimed dog turd in the hall outside the bathroom. People sat in small groups talking about the other small groups that were just out of earshot. My ex and the dancer made a brief appearance, but I held my head high. I was wearing my best Gap turtleneck, and my dates were two adult lesbians, so yeah, I was pretty cool. The Summer Showtime kids had to weave nervously through the jocks to get to the Doritos. Brendan's long-suffering Catholic school girlfriend, Patty, tried to bridge the gap between the two groups. A sweet, quiet girl with short, curly hair and a face as Irish as a scone, Patty seemed to be the only person at the party who didn't realize what Brendan's deal was. Even the family dog had registered his disapproval again on the kitchen floor. Brendan and I ran into each other out on the front lawn. He seemed to be in a particularly Oscar Wilde mood. "May I kiss you?" he asked. "Sure, who cares?" After a tender, play-acted, non-French kiss, Brendan suddenly came out to me. In my experience, the hardest thing about having someone come out to you is the pretending to be surprised part. You want him to feel like what he's telling you is big. It's like if someone tells you they're pregnant, you don't say, "Oh, I did notice you've been eating like a hog lately." Your gay friend has obviously made a big decision to say the words out loud, and you don't want him to realize that everybody's known this since he was 10 and he wanted to be Bert Lahr for Halloween. Not the Cowardly Lion, but Bert Lahr. "Oh my gosh, no way!" You stall, trying to think of something more substantial to say. "Is everyone, like, freaking out? What a... wow." Brendan had clearly decided to make this party his gaybut, and he wandered through the crowd performing his one-man show in various locations. Bored, I tried making out with Victor Anthony, a straight kid who was cute but kind of a wang. He was the cream of wheat of making out. I would try it every now and again, thinking, oh, maybe I'll like it, but every time, no. He really was a stunningly bad kisser. It was as if he took a running start at your mouth. Brendan's stage kiss was way more skilled. I came back inside and parked it with Karen and Sharon in the theater living room, where Brendan was deep into Act Two of Coming Out. The Monsignor Bonner football team was peering in from the dining area, hearing all of this. "Here's a toast to being free of other people's expectations," Brendan monologued, "and loving whomever you choose." In the background, scone-faced Patty was quietly giving people coasters. Jesus, she was really not getting it. This evening was actually turning out to be quite boring. But then, it happened. One of the drunk girls from the Archbishop Prendergast side of the party wandered into the Showtime room and started making out with Alexis Catalano. Everybody froze. Patty looked on, scone-faced. This was unprecedented. Brendan talked a good game, but these two girls were going at it in public. This was years before every pop singer in the world started fake lezzing out on the VMAs. It simply was not done. What would happen next? Karen and Sharon went into protective adult mode and pulled the two wasted girls apart and took them upstairs to a more private location. Just then, Brendan's mom, who was totally unaware of the proceedings, started screaming and throwing everyone's coats down the stairs, which shall henceforth be known as an Irish goodnight. Brendan's mom may have perfected my party shutdown move, but it didn't stop me from working it at the amateur level. I followed the four women upstairs, ducking the flying parkas, because it was almost 2 a.m., my special expanded New Year's Eve curfew. Karen was my ride, and we needed to get a move on. Alexis and the jock girl were so drunk they could barely function. Karen and Sharon tried to convince them it was time to call it a night. They would give them a ride home. "Oh, I love her," jock girl sobbed as Karen helped her get her coat on. I said I'd be waiting in the car, and they needed to hurry up. Meanwhile, Brendan stormed out of the house and drove away, furious, probably because he had lost the room when two girls started going to town on each other. After I'd been waiting in the car 20 minutes and missed my curfew, I couldn't control my temper anymore. "Get the dykes in the car!" I screamed down Child's Avenue, banging my shoe on Karen's dashboard and leaving a slight crack. My husband could tell you that I still get this wound up when I'm trying to leave the house on a Saturday morning and nobody in my family has their shoes on. It's not a great quality. And just in case you were wondering, yes, when he returned later that night, Brendan tried to run Patty and his mother over with the car. I believe it earned him a Regional Theater Tony nomination. The second summer. By my second year at Summer Showtime, I was promoted to be one of the children's theater directors. I directed shows with a cast of 60 12-year-olds, and all toot my own horn, I made some interesting directing choices, such as pushing the Little Mermaid around on a rolling office chair papier-mâchéd to look like a large shell. Her hair only got caught in the wheels twice. I knew everyone. I was fully immersed. Immersed, Brendan would say. "You're so smart. Why don't I know more people who use words like immersed?" And then he'd disappear for 2 days. He may have been a drunk. Sharon's brother, Sean, was our visiting director for the main stage musical. Everyone referred to him as equity actor Sean Kenny. He was a member of the Stage Actors Union. He was living the dream in a basement-level studio apartment in Hell's Kitchen with a rat problem. We were all in awe. Sean was and is a skilled and confident director. I was excited to be his assistant director on a murder mystery musical called Something's Afoot. My first job as assistant director was to make sure he didn't cast the talented blonde dancer who had so easily stolen my boyfriend the summer before. I accomplished this with the persistent and skilled manipulation of a grade-A bitch. I made articulate arguments as to why the other blonde girl would be better. The dancer girl was too overused. It would be more exciting to use someone unexpected, and the other girl's look was more British. A fat load of nonsense, but it worked. Dancer girl was relegated to playing the title role in a children's theater show called Guess Again. Yes, her character and the show were both called Guess Again. It was a harsh punishment. Obviously, as an adult, I realize this girl-on-girl sabotage is the third worst kind of female behavior, right behind saying like all the time and leaving your baby in a dumpster. I'm proud to say that I would never sabotage a fellow female like that now. Not even if Christina Applegate and I were both up for the same part as Vince Vaughn's mother in a big-budget comedy called Beer Guys. Sean and I were mentor and mentee that summer. I was 18 and he was 27. Sean taught me a lot about professional dignity. For example, this was when call waiting was new, and if you left Sean on the other line for more than 10 seconds, he would hang up. And our show was a hit on both nights. The cast party was in a backyard with paper lanterns. The cast and crew mingled. It was very glamorous. Summer Showtime alum Richard Diatelis was there. Years before, my friend Vanessa had gone to her eighth grade dance with Richard Diatelis, and he had picked her up wearing a baseball shirt customized with an iron-on photo of Olivia Newton-John. It said, Olivia Newton-John in puffy letters on the front and totally hot on the back. Richard had been the first of the Showtime boys to quietly come out after his stint at the Pennsylvania Governor's School for the Arts, an exclusive state-run arts intensive that might as well have been called the Pennsylvania Governor's Blowjob Academy. Imagine a bunch of 17-year-old theater boys away from home for the first time for 6 weeks. They were living in empty college dorms for the love of Mike, literally. Think of the joy and freedom they must have felt like being on an all-gay space station. I'm sure there were one or two straight boys there, too, and I imagine they did incredibly well with the one or two straight girls. Sean was flirting with Richard. We were seated at a picnic table at the party, and I realized they were playing footsie under the table. I could not contain my judgment. What are you doing? I demanded, trying to be funny and controlling at the same time. They ignored me. Richard got up to get a soda. I turned to Sean. He's so cheesy and gross. My power of suggestion technique had worked so well when I was screwing over that blonde girl. I used any ammunition I could muster. He smokes, you know. As the night wore on, I didn't get the hint. I stayed at the table with two people who were clearly going to hook up. I tried some sarcastic eye contact as Richard told Sean about his dream to turn Xanadu into a stage play. Like that would ever work. In my mind, I was doing Sean a favor by trying to stop him from hooking up with someone regrettable. Oh my God, you know he's only like 20. Sabotage and saying like. I was really in a bad place. Sean shot me a look. I was out of bounds. It's one thing to be a wisecracking, precocious teen hanging out with 27-year-olds. It's another thing to get in the way of a grown man trying to get laid. I don't know what happened between Richard and Sean that night, but the next day, Sharon called me to say that Sean was very annoyed with the way I behaved. She said she talked him down because they all realized that I had a crush on Sean. It's natural. They all realized? They were all talking about what a baby I was and how I must have a crush on Sean. I don't. I wept from sheer embarrassment. I really don't. But the more I protested, the guiltier I seemed. And here, after 20 years, is the truth. I really didn't have a crush on Sean. I had reacted that way because I viscerally felt that what they were about to do was icky. The stomachache I felt had nothing to do with the crush. I had to face the fact that I had been using my gay friends as props. They were always supposed to be funny and entertain me and praise me and listen to my problems, and their life was supposed to be a secret that no one wanted to hear about. I wanted them to stay in the half closet. Equity actor Sean Kenny did not live in the half closet. He had moved away to New York and was just back for a visit. He was a grown man. My reaction to his hooking up with Richard Diatelis made me feel like Coach Garth. I stroked my thick blonde mustache and thunk about what I had done. It was a major and deeply embarrassing teenage revelation. It must be how straight teenage boys feel when they realize those boobs they like have heads attached to them. I thought I knew everything after that first summer. Being gay is not a choice. Gay people were made that way by God, I'd lectured Mr. Garth proudly. But it took me another whole year to figure out the second part. Gay people were made that way by God, but not solely for my entertainment. We can't expect our gay friends to always be single, celibate, and arriving early with the nacho fixins. And we really need to let these people get married already. Before the final performance of every summer, all the kids were invited on stage, and together we sang To Fill the World with Love from Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Everyone would cry their heads off. It felt like the end of camp, and I imagine some of those kids had more to dread about going back to school than just boredom and health class. With his dream of a theater program for young people, Larry Wensler had inadvertently done an amazing thing for all these squirrels. They had a place where they belonged, and even if it was because he didn't want to deal with their being different, he didn't treat them any differently, which I think is a pretty successful implementation of Christianity. We should strive to make our society more like summer showtime. Mostly a meritocracy, despite some vicious backstabbing. Everyone gets a spot in the chorus. Bring white shorts from home. That's Don Fay. Let's review the cost-free techniques that we've learned so far for raising an achievement-oriented, obedient, drug-free virgin adult. Calamity. Praise. Local theater. Flat feet. Another key element is strong father figure slash fear thereof. My dad looks like Clint Eastwood. His half-Scottish, half-German face in repose is handsome but terrifying. I searched the audience for him during the sixth grade chorus concert, and seeing his stern expression was convinced that he had seen me messing up the words to the Happy Days theme and that I was in big trouble. I spent the rest of the concert suppressing terror burps, only to be given a big hug and a kiss afterward. It took me years to realize, oh, that's just his face. It's my face, too, it turns out. The cheekbones later discovered there by a team of gay excavators are courtesy of my dad. Don Fay dresses well. He has an artist's eye for mixing colors and prints. He wears tweedy jackets over sweater vests in the winter and seersucker suits in the summer. His garnet college ring shows off his well-groomed hands. He can still rock a hat. My dad looks like he's somebody. One day when I was visiting him on his lunch hour, he ran into a couple of old high school buddies in downtown Philadelphia. Hey, Don Fay! One of the guys called from across the street. Oh my God, Don Fay! The other guy said excitedly. The two African-American secretaries waiting at the light with my dad whispered knowingly to each other. That's Don Fay. Before I was born, my mother took my brother to Greece for the whole summer to visit family. When they were finally coming back, my dad washed and waxed his Chevy convertible, put on his best sharkskin suit, and drove all the way from Philadelphia to New York International Airport to pick them up. In those days, international travel meant dressing up, smoking on planes, wearing Pan Am slippers, and flying into New York. Their flight was due to arrive early in the morning, so Don Fay, who is never late for anything, got to the airport just before dawn. As he popped on his sweet lid and walked across the deserted parking lot toward the terminal, he saw two black gentlemen approaching from far away. He played it cool to hide his apprehension. He was in New York, after all, one of the world's most dangerous cities, if you're from any other city, and from far away, in the dark, he couldn't tell if the guys were airport employees or loiterers. As they got closer, he noticed they were staring him down. He continued to play it cool. Don Fay had grown up in West Philly, where he lived comfortably as a Caucasian minority. Of course, these guys didn't know that. His heart was beating a little faster as they came within 10 feet of each other. The guys looked at him intently, and then one guy turned to the other guy and said, "That is one boss, bold, bladed motherfucker." That's Don Fay. He's just a badass. He was a codebreaker in Korea. He was a fireman in Philadelphia. He's a skilled watercolorist. He's written 2 mystery novels. He taught himself Greek so well that when he went to buy tickets to the Acropolis once, the docent told him, "Boria isodosia, Elena. It's free for Greek citizens. You go in. It's free." Neighborhood kids would gather on our porch just to listen to him swear at the Phillies game. Andy Musser talked too goddamn much. Games were often over by the 6th inning. "This goddamn game is over. The sons of bitches choked." When watching the Flyers, he would change the channel during commercials, and he always knew exactly when to turn it back to catch the start of play. When my cousin marveled at this ability, my dad was matter-of-fact, "You just wait 90 seconds. Isn't everyone's brain a Swiss watch?" Don Fay is a Goldwater Republican, which is his only option. If you're Don Fay, you can't look at Joe Biden and be like, "Yes, I want to be led by this gentleman with the capped teeth." You're not going to listen to John Kerry pretending to empathize with you about the rising cost of your medications. You certainly aren't interested in the unresolved father issues that rendered Bill Clinton unable to keep his fly closed. Don Fay is not going to put up with that. Don Fay is a grown-ass man. Black people find him stylish. Don Fay has what I would describe as pre-Norman Lear racial attitudes. Once the Bunker family met the Jeffersons, every interaction between blacks and whites was somehow supposed to be a life-changing lesson, especially for the white people. My generation carries that with us, only to be constantly disappointed by Kanye West and Taylor Swift. The little twin house I grew up in was across the street from the border of West Philadelphia, where Don Fay grew up. Don Fay certainly has friends of other races and religions. He's told me a couple of times about the night he kissed Lionel Hampton. He was at a jazz concert as a teenager with an all-white audience. At one point in the show, Lionel Hampton would invite a woman from the audience to dance with him, but the white girls were all too scared to be seen dancing with a black man. Lionel Hampton was just left hanging there. To ease the tension, Don Fay jumped up and fast danced with Mr. Hampton, at the end of which Lionel Hampton kissed him on the forehead to a round of applause. Conversely, he would tell us things like, "If you see two blackheads riding around on one bike, put your bike in the garage." This wasn't racism, it was experience. Those kids were coming from West Philly to steal bikes. The social factors that caused their behavior were irrelevant to a depression baby. When you grow up getting an orange for Christmas, you're going to make sure that the $25 bike you bought your kid doesn't get ripped off. Norman Lear might want us to take time to understand that those kids went to poorly funded schools and that their parents, while loving and dignified, were unable to supervise their children's behavior because they were both at work doing minimum wage jobs. But by then, our bikes would be gone. The late 70s were a dark time of family meetings and tightening our belts. The embarrassment of Watergate led right into the Iran hostage crisis. 3 Mile Island was in our state. It was always day 27 of something in Beirut. There was an infestation of gypsy moths killing the trees in our neighborhood. I can definitely remember a period of time when the gas crisis, the Carter administration, and Alan Alda's bleeding heart liberal propaganda were starting to wear on Don Fay's day-to-day dignity. One Saturday, my dad got it in his head that he was going to rent a rug shampooer at Pathmark and shampoo our carpets. He expressed this desire to my mother, who said nonchalantly, "Ugh, those things never work." We still had a half-empty bottle of rug shampoo from the other time he'd tried it, but Don Fay could not be deterred. And I, his faithful servant, went with him. We rented the shampooer, bought a new full bottle of soap, and loaded them into the back of the Catalina. When we got home, I was sent to play outside so my dad could shampoo the whole first floor. I barely had my Star Wars figures lined up in the patch of dirt by the basement steps, also known as Tatooine, when I heard a commotion inside. My dad was cursing. Objects were being rumbled around. I got an instant bellyache. The screen door flew open. The two bottles of rug shampoo were slammed onto the back porch. The rug shampooer came tumbling out the back door in a tangled mess. "Your mother is a witch," my dad blurted as he came outside. He meant it literally. "She cursed me." It would seem that the rented rug shampooer did not work. "The goddamn thing is defective." Defective was a big word in our house. Many things were labeled defective, only to miraculously turn functional once the directions had been read more thoroughly. If I had to name the two words I most associate with my dad between 1970 and 1990, they would be defective and inexcusable. Leaving your baseball glove in a neighbor's car, inexcusable. Not knowing that a lot was two words, inexcusable. The seltzer machine we were going to use to make homemade soda, defective. The misspelled sign at the Beach Boys' 4th of July concert that read, "From Sea to Shinning Sea," inexcusable. Richie Ashburn not being in the Baseball Hall of Fame yet, bullshit. Don Fay also had a large rubber stamp that said bullshit, which was and is awesome. Was it too much to expect the rest of the world to care about grammar or pay attention to details? Shouldn't someone at the Pathmark have to make sure that the goddamn rug shampooers are in working order? He carried the defective shampooer down the back steps, the hose flopping around on purpose just to annoy him. There was sudsy water inside it, sloshing around, mocking his dream of an orderly house. Son of a bitch! As he backed our giant car up the 50-degree incline of our driveway, scraping the bumper, he barked, "Get the bottle of soap! Come on!" I was going along for the ride back to Pathmark. Great.